Thank you, Rob. Good morning, everyone. Thank you again for allowing me to share Divrei Torah with you on a Sunday morning. One of the most fascinating challenges that poskim always face is how to rule on questions of halacha for which there really cannot be any firm halachic precedent. Simply because the circumstances that create the halachic question that they're faced with today just did not exist in the times of the Gemara, in the times of the Rishonim, times of the Shulchan Aruch, and very often even 25, 30 years ago. And what's fascinating to see in such halachic situations is how the poskim, you know, comb through the halachic makoros available to find what would seem to be the best available parallel to then draw conclusions from to those issues that they deal with today. And one of the most critical and perhaps unfortunately very common examples that poskim deal with today is in the issue of infertility, because about 15% of couples today will not conceive within the first 12 months of trying. And although for many, for 85%, comes very naturally, for 15%, 12 months of trying will often not produce the desired results. And in this field of reproductive technology, of fertility treatments, there have been tremendous advances made in recent years. And advances that continue to be made as time goes on. And it's only in recent times that poskim have dealt with these very critical questions as related to these fertility treatments. Before I begin, I just want to express hakaras hatov to the yeshiva. It was here that I had the opportunity about 2 years ago to take part in a year-long seminar hosted by the yeshiva in conjunction with Machon Puah in Yerushalayim. A seminar in which they brought in different speakers, Rosh Yeshiva, medical professionals, every week to discuss these issues. And it's really as a result of that program that I am able to share with you today. Just by way of introduction, you know, the question of paternity and maternity was always very, very simple. You had a husband and a wife, a man and a woman, there was a union, there was a child, you have no questions. This is their son, this is the father, this is the mother, end of story, let's go home. However, today, with the various forms of AI, artificial insemination, that are readily available and practiced in the in fertility circles and fertility treatment clinics, it's entirely possible for man and woman to have a child without ever seeing each other. And obviously when a child is created in ways that were heretofore unimaginable just a number of decades ago, the question becomes, how does halacha relate to such paternity and maternity claims? What is it that really makes a woman a mother? What is it that really makes a father as far as halacha is concerned? And this is a very critical question, obviously. Number one, just to cite a couple of practical applications, the issue of marrying one's siblings. Okay? Always very easily avoidable. Brothers and sisters, no, they can't marry each other. But what happens when you have a bit of a challenge in deciding who the father or the mother of a child is? Halacha has to come to a determination to avoid this possibility of two siblings marrying one another, perhaps not even knowing that they are siblings. You might have heard on Friday there was a case in Britain just that made the news. Two twins separated at birth, never knew they even had a twin, and just discovered, High Court in Britain ruled they had to annul their marriage because they had met, I don't know how, they had gotten engaged and married somehow, and they found out after they were married that they happened to have been twins from birth, they never knew each other, and their marriage was just annulled. Now that's not even getting into these high-tech reproductive technology kind of situations. But it's entirely possible to have such a, albeit not common, but such a situation where brothers and sisters might end up marrying one another if they're not careful. So obviously that's one very important nafka mina in terms of maternity and paternity as to who is allowed or not allowed to marry one another. A second very relevant question, and perhaps the most basic, is every man has a mitzvah of pruravu, to try and have children. At what point do we tell a man that he has fulfilled his mitzvah of pruravu? Is pruravu fulfilled only through the tried and true method of generations of an actual physical union between man and woman? Or is pruravu simply having a genetic biological offspring, even if produced in some other newer method? And finally, just one last application to mention for this morning, although there certainly are others. Yerusha, inheritance. It's usually very simple. Someone dies, children inherit him, sons take the father's possessions, they are the heirs. What happens when you have a question as to who the actual heirs really are? And just to highlight the sensitivity of these issues, if you look on the first page, right in the middle of the page, this is an excerpt from the London Times. It was also on Fox News back in January, about almost a year ago. This was a tragic case in Israel that had been going through the courts for a number of years, 4 or 5 years. You can read the story. It's very self-explanatory. Unfortunately, a young chayal, Kaivin, I'm not sure how to pronounce his first name, Kaivin Cohen, was shot dead by a sniper in Gaza in 2002. And 20 years old, died young, never married. And upon hearing of his death, his mother, Rachel Cohen, who realized that she would no longer be able to see any future from her murdered son, immediately decided to take a sample, a semen sample, from his dead body, which can be done within, I think, a short time after one's death. And she had that sample stored, frozen in liquid nitrogen. And then she requested permission from the courts to use this sample to then allow her dead son to become the father of a child who he would never know, by allowing a woman who her son never knew to bear this child for her dead son. And the question, obviously, that the Israeli courts had to deal with was, is this legal? Is this ethical? Is this allowed? And as you can see here from the article, about 4.5 years later or so, about a year ago, the Israeli courts allowed this petition to go through. They allowed this mother to produce a son from her dead child, from her dead son. And the question then becomes, obviously, what happens in the eyes of halacha? Number one, is this allowed? Number two, does this dead son now become a father posthumously? Think about Yerusha. Theoretically, you could have somebody who dies and leaves, let's say, 2 heirs and a sample, a semen sample, and 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years down the line, all of a sudden, someone else is claiming a share of the fortune. Someone who his brothers never knew, never heard about, never wanted to know, and all of a sudden, you know, someone's making a claim in court for for a third of the fortune. So how does halacha deal with such an issue? So let's begin with going back to the basic question of AI, of artificial insemination. See how Postman dealt with that issue, first of all. One touch. Okay. Artificial insemination is credited to Dr. John Hunter, who was a personal physician of Queen Charlotte and King George III. I guess not a couple that's too well loved in this country. That was in the mid to late 1700s. And he was the first physician in 1785 to perform an artificial insemination, an IUI, an intrauterine insemination, when a woman was allowed or able to conceive without a direct union with her husband, but by means of a catheter that was used to inject the semen, the zera, into her womb. And following that first success, certainly technology has advanced many times since then, and today artificial insemination is practiced not just with IUI, intrauterine insemination, but also with the very common IVF, in vitro fertilization, in which a semen sample is taken from the husband, an egg is taken from the mother, from the woman, and is fertilized outside of the body in a lab and then implanted into the mother a few days later. Just to give you an idea how common this is, the most recent statistics that are available in this country are from the year 2005 on the SART website, which is the Society for Assisted Reproduction and Technologies. In the year 2005, there were over 120,000 IVF procedures in this country alone. In terms of live births, I believe in 2000, I think the percentage rate is about 28% of IVF cycles result in live births. So if you figure 20% of 120,000 or so, I guess you'll get somewhere in the area of, I don't know, 26,000? 40,000? Wide range. Any other suggestions? I didn't calculate it. Okay, I'll leave that to you. Right, you have multiple births, right. Okay. I think in the year 2003, I did see that the statistics were 26,000 deliveries out of 91,000 attempts. So it's obviously gone up since 2003. In 2 years, it's gone up significantly. Okay, the question the post can deal with is, again, all these issues, how do you define paternity and pre-revue as far as this question is concerned? So if you look in source number one, comment of the Beis Shmuel. The Beis Shmuel is reacting to an earlier comment of the Chelkas Mechokek, one of the commentaries on the side of Shulchan Aruch Aben HaEzer. The Chelkas Mechokek raised the following question. And he refers us to a comment in the Gemara in Chagiga, which, you know, when you first see this Gemara in Chagiga, you wonder whether it's strikes you somewhat perhaps as puzzling, as strange. You wonder whether it's even medically possible. But what's fascinating is to see how this theoretical case mentioned in the Gemara in Chagiga, whether or not you actually consider it medically possible or not, is certainly the most relevant source we have today for these halacha l'maaseh shailos. And that case is the following. The Gemara in Chagiga talks of a woman who conceived not through a union between a man and a woman, but rather because she bathed in water in which another man had bathed in previously. Again, you see this Gemara the first time, you wonder, is this possible? Is it medically possible? I don't know. But the bottom line is thanks to this theoretical case in the Gemara, we now have the one source, the most critical source in halacha today to enable us to deal with these very relevant, applicable shailos of today. And the Chelkas Mechokek, in commenting on this Gemara in Chagiga about a woman who conceives in this very unusual way, asks, is the father in fulfillment of his mitzvah of having a child, of pru revu, this unintending father, who perhaps never even knew the woman who became the mother of his son? And the Chelkas Mechokek says he's not sure. He doesn't know if this father unwittingly becomes a father to the point of fulfilling the mitzvah of pru revu or not. However, the Beis Shmuel, in commenting on this Chelkas Mechokek's comment, says, I think, and he proves, that the offspring of this unwitting father is credited to this father. It is his child in every which way. He writes that, look at the last line of source number one, he says, Nishma dehevei bino l'chol davar. That even when there is such an unusual conception, without an actual physical union between father and mother, he says, the child is considered the offspring of this father in every way, as far as halakha is concerned. Meaning, he holds, he says, that the father would actually fulfill the mitzvah of pru revu, even though he became a father unwittingly without ever having seen this woman who became the mother of his child. He does write that, however, one must be careful to always ensure that you can ascertain the proper identity of the father of this child. Now, when you're dealing with conception where the mother and father might not even see one another, you have to know who the father is. If you don't know who the father is, then you run the question of, again, siblings marrying one another unwittingly. But assuming we have identified who the father of this child is, the Beis Shmuel rules that the father would be credited with the mitzvah of pru revu by having this child. Comes the Taz, 1600s, and he questions this statement of the Beis Shmuel. The Taz in source number two, if you look in the middle of this first line in source number two, the Taz says, the Ein Zeraya. I don't understand this proof, he says. D'shema l'chumra amrinan, l'kula lo amrinan. maybe only Lechumra will assume to be safe that perhaps this is the son of this unwitting father, but not Lekula, meaning maybe we'll be concerned that this is this man's son as far as not allowing him to marry a daughter of this father. Lechumra will be worried this is his son. But Lekula, to say that he actually is exempted now from his obligation of Pru or Vu, that says the Taz, you have no right to assume. So the Taz suggests that perhaps we'll, you know, on the safe side, be worried that maybe a father in a situation of artificial insemination will be the father as far as not allowing the son to marry a sibling from that same father. But to assume that this unwitting father has now fulfilled his mitzvah of Pru or Vu, that says the Taz, we don't necessarily have a right to do. And he concludes by saying, "Beprat b'midi t'tali b'kum pa'aseh." And especially, Puravu is a mitzvah. God says, get up and do something. So to say that you have fulfilled the mitzvah of actively performing a mitzvah saseh, in this case, v'hunis abra me'atzma, when a woman conceives just unwittingly, by mistake, without anyone having actively done anything, that, says the Taz, is not really so logical. So the Taz says that in this kind of theoretical situation the Gemara speaks of a woman conceiving by bathing in someone else's water where she and he didn't do anything active to actually have their father a child, the Taz says that you can't tell me that in that situation they have fulfilled the mitzvah Peru, who they didn't do anything. They didn't know they were doing anything, they didn't do anything, they didn't try to do anything. There's no mitzvah saseh that was done here. Now, if we were to apply that, however, to today's fertility clinics, the Taz's logic perhaps wouldn't carry through. Why not? Right. Today, when a couple in need of fertility assistance goes to a clinic, they're doing whatever they can do, and they intend to do whatever they can do to have a child. It's not by accident, unwitting, man and a woman happen to have been in the same place once and happen to conceive. That's not what happens here. When they both go to a clinic and they want to do whatever they can to conceive, the husband's doing whatever is in his power to have a child in whatever way he can medically do it. And for that reason, perhaps one could argue today that a father would very much be in fulfillment, would fulfill his mitzvah of Pru Revu by having a child even through assisted reproductive methods used today. And that, in fact, is the psak of the Minchas Yitzchak of Dayan Weiss in a shuvah that he wrote in 1953, source number 3. Source number 3, Dayan Weiss writes, he says that one can make a very simple distinction. With regard to our case, there's a very, very simple distinction, he says. Through artificial insemination, everyone could agree that you have fulfilled, in fact, your mitzvah of Pru Revu. Because the woman did not conceive unwittingly by herself. But rather, there was tremendous effort expended here to enable her to conceive. And therefore, Dayan Weiss paskins that today, when a couple, through the assistance of fertility treatment, will conceive through artificial insemination, through IVF, Dayan Weiss writes that a father would definitely fulfill his mitzvah of Pru Revu, even though the child was not fathered in the old tried and true method. But the bottom line is, he did actively do whatever he could do to have a child. Biologically, it's his child. Therefore, this is considered his son as far as the mitzvah of Pru Revu is concerned. So with regard to that issue of Pru Revu, it would seem clear that today, Dayan Weiss tells us, a father would fulfill his mitzvah of Pru Revu through fathering a child, even by means of artificial insemination or assisted reproduction as practiced today. And certainly with regard to consanguinity, which I think is the term for siblings marrying one another, as well, a father who fathers a child through artificial insemination, this obviously would be his child, with regard to the prohibition of this child not marrying any one of this father's any other children. And that certainly is a concern that has to be dealt with very carefully, to always ensure that the identity of the parents is guarded very carefully so that everyone knows, I don't mean guarded in secrecy, I meant watched carefully so that everyone knows that this is actually the father and this is actually the mother of the child. When we toured the fertility clinic of Dr. Richard Grazi in Bar Park, we met with, I believe his name is Rabbi Friedlander, who was the mashgiach there in the clinic, and he showed us semen samples that they had stored there in a tank of liquid nitrogen, literally padlocked shut with a key and lock. He had the key. He was the one in charge of overseeing that there would be no identity mix-up to ensure that the intended father is also the actual father. There have been, unfortunately, cases documented in the news where there have been mix-ups. In 2004, in New Haven, Connecticut, a woman by the name of Laura Howard sued her fertility specialist because she was given the wrong sample in the clinic and ended up being the mother of someone else's child, not her own husband's child. And that wasn't the first case, unfortunately. There was a case earlier in the late 90s in Virginia. Dr. Jacobson in Virginia as well was found to have been guilty of a similar violation, I should say. So certainly, you know, great care needs to be exercised in these areas to ensure that there is no such mix-up. Not just as far as the desires of the parents is concerned, but as far as halacha is concerned, it's a very, very serious issue.
Is it halachic necessity to have a mashgiach?
It's a good question. The question really becomes, who are you entrusting with the samples? So, for example, in the Shaar Tzedek Hospital, where the lab technician who actually works with the samples and performs the IVF ICSI procedures in which the sperm sample is injected manually into an egg, but with the aid of a microscope, there the technician is a frum Jew, reliable individual, and Rav Eliashiv passed that there was no need to have outside supervision in that case because you had a very trusted religious Orthodox Jew who was actually in charge of overseeing it. Machon Pua, on the other hand, is very much active in encouraging and facilitating the use of rabbinic supervision in these clinics to avoid any such mix-ups. And they do provide hashgacha, not just in Israel, but even in many centers in the tri-state area here as well, where obviously you might not always be fortunate enough to have such a, you know, from Jew as your lab technician in charge of the samples in the lab. So obviously there's much more of a concern when there's someone who's, you know, not religious and not trustworthy handling the samples. So they do encourage and try to facilitate such supervision. Whether it's actually strictly required, that might depend who you ask. Yes, Rabbi Rath.
Of the fear of not making
an error, right? So that's what I'm saying. I don't know if it's halakhically required. Now, having seen these few errors here or there, you know, obviously there is room for concern. But I'm sure that this Dr. Jacobson in Virginia is no longer practicing his original career. So, you know, obviously there is a very strong mirsus here, a fear that they have self-imposed. That's why I don't know if it's necessarily halakhically required. It's, you know, nice thing to have, might be comforting, certainly. I can't say it's necessarily required, but it's a good point. Yes?
If there is a mistake and they discover it either before they implant the fertilized egg or upon implantation, that somehow they discover that there was a mistake, a different father, what do they actually do?
So in that case in New Haven, Connecticut, the doctor gave Mrs. Laura Howard a morning after pill, which she, for whatever reason, refused to take and preferred to sue instead. Makes you wonder. Obviously, medically there is, I guess, something to do if you discover the mistake right away. Not everyone is that fortunate. Sometimes you discover it way too late, like 9 months too late, in which case, nothing you can do. Yes?
Is there a question about serious woman is married?
That's a very serious question. That's a very good question. I was not going to get into the details of that question because that's a share unto itself, but it's a good question to deal with. That is a subject of a very heated debate between Gedolei HaPoskim. Rav Moshe Feinstein was of the opinion that there is no mamzerus if there was no actual physical union between the man and the woman. And he therefore was of the opinion that if, let's say, the donor sample is not from one's husband, it was from some other individual, Rav Moshe held there was no mamzerus there. Others disagreed. The Satmar Rav very, very fiercely so. Rav Shachter Shlita quotes Rav Yosef Engel as well as having been concerned for the mamzerus possibility if it's a married woman receiving some other man's sample. I think even Shlomo Zalman is uncertain about it. So for that reason, that really gets involved in the question of, well, then do you prefer a sample from a non-Jew, which would not create any mamzerus issues, or do you prefer the sample of a Jew, which according to Moshe is okay, but according to other poskim is not? That's a very serious question. But that is a question that's debated by the poskim and disagreed upon. Okay. Let's move on now to the other question we raised with regard to artificial insemination and paternity. And that relates to the question of Yerusha. And especially with regard to posthumous paternity. How does that figure into the halacha? In this case in particular, here from Eretz Yisrael. There is a very fascinating question in the Note of Yehuda, in Eben Ezra, Chelek Aleph, Simon Samach Tes. The Note of Yehuda was dealing with the following question. There was a couple that had been married for 7 years without any children. The husband became very ill, was lying on his deathbed. In the last few days before his death, there were people around him, you know, 24/7, keeping watch, staying with him. And 9 months and about 2 weeks after his death, his wife gives birth to a healthy baby. And the question was, for 7 years they didn't have any children, you presume that this woman is now going to be required to undergo a chalitza when her husband dies without any children. And 9 months and 2 weeks after his death, she, for the first time, had a child. And there were some other mysterious circumstances coupled with this in this case as well. Now, she'd only gone to the mikvah 2 weeks before he died, and there are people around his bedside nonstop. And the question was, do we have to assume that this was the deceased's child, or was it someone else's child? And would this woman have to undergo chalitza or not? That was a much more complicated issue he dealt with at length. But in the course of dealing with this question and discussing, you know, whose child this was, this can be assumed to be, does this woman have to undergo chalitza or not? So he writes here in source number 5, the Nodav Yehuda writes, he says, V'imkein, and if so, ani omer, I say, isha shelo kol tahazera kodem misas baila. What would happen if, theoretically, a woman had been with her husband right before he died? But the actual fertilization of the egg did not occur until after he died. It takes some time. So he'd been with the husband right before he died. Fertilization occurs only after he dies. What happens then? So the Buddha says, "Afsha kolta achar moso ubinohu lechol davar." Even though this child will be the son of the deceased in every area of halacha. Mikol makom, nevertheless, he says, l'inyan yibum, as far as yibum is concerned, kvar karinim ba ubein ein lo bishas misa. As far as yibum is concerned, we look at only whether there was a child there at the moment of death. At that moment, there was nothing. Therefore, this woman would be liable for either a yibum or a chalitza. But he says, as far as every other area of halacha is concerned, since ultimately there was fertilization here as a result of the union between the husband and the wife right before he died, this would be considered the husband's son. Now this would appear to indicate that even in a situation where fertilization occurs posthumously, and even though with regard to Yibum perhaps the woman would be obligated to undergo a chalitza or a Yibum because at the moment of death there were no children yet, but the Nodav Yehuda says that benohu l'chol davar. As far as everything else is concerned, this child that is fathered by the deceased the moment before he dies is considered his son with regard to every area of halacha. What would that seem to indicate? I'm sorry? It would seem to indicate, okay, so as far as yivum, we're machmir, but in every other respect, we would assume that it is his son. So as far as posthumous appearance of newly found heirs to someone's small fortune, according to the Yehuda, presumably you could argue that, well, even if a Yorish only comes onto the scene posthumously, If it is indeed someone who is genetically a son of the deceased, that's his son, and this is a Yorish, this is someone who gets his share of the fortune. However, one could draw a very simple distinction. What would that distinction be? Yeah? Correct.
Whereas the case of Rachel Cohen, who's already
interested. Right, exactly. So Shaul Yisraeli, is that Sal, makes exactly that point. He says you can't prove from this note of Yehuda that posthumously if a child is born 5 years later after someone's death, that this is a legal heir as far as Allah is concerned. The case of the note of Yehuda is a case where the father did whatever he would ordinarily do right before he died. So he did what he had to do to earn the paternity status in Halacha. But in the case of Rachel Cohen here, or Kaivin Cohen, he never did anything before he died to become a father. Everything was done after he died by others. So if Shaul Yisraeli would pass in this situation, that the posthumously born child who appears on the scene 5 years later is not entitled to any Yerusha, any inheritance whatsoever, and might not be considered a son halachically. If Shlomo Zalman Orbach, however, strikingly says he disagrees. He says that he feels that as far as Yerusha is concerned, even if an heir appears on the scene years later, biologically, genetically, it's this deceased's son, you can become a Yorish even if you did not exist at the time of the passing. He says there does not have to be anything done by the father before he dies to create a Yorish. If genetically, biologically, a Yorish is born years later, according to Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, that person would be entitled to a Yerusha as far as Halacha is concerned. So there seems to be a machlokas haposkim of Yisraeli of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach with regard to Yerusha, whether a posthumously born heir, where the deceased did not do anything to bring about the birth of this child, would be entitled to Yerusha or not. Just to wrap up before we move on, this issue of posthumous birth and paternity, there is a very fascinating article written by Dr. Ruth Landau, who is a professor of social work at Hebrew University. She published this article in the Journal of the European Society of Human Reproduction and Embryology a number of years ago. And in her article, she essentially critiques the Knesset, which passed a law allowing for posthumous insemination and fathering of children posthumously. And the Knesset essentially, I believe, back in 2003, passed a law allowing posthumous insemination, provided that there is no proof that the deceased would have objected. Which means, according to that law passed by the Knesset, if the mother, the wife of this deceased individual, wants a posthumous child, that in that law that was passed in 2003 would say, well, if we have no reason to believe that the deceased would have objected, then go right ahead, which is incredible, because most people don't think that this is going to be an issue while they're alive. And then to claim that you have a right to do that after someone dies without, because no one said no, is a very, very striking law to pass. And she critiques this law at length in this article. She discusses how one must be concerned not just with the wishes of the mother or the wife, but with the well-being of this planned orphan, as she calls it. You know, the health of this child psychologically. What is this child going to endure growing up, knowing that his or her father died 25 years or 100 years earlier? It's a little strange. That's a little frightening, too. I don't know if, you know, if the law is still on the books in that same, exactly the same way today, that I don't know, but certainly is something which ethically and psychologically poses great concern. Okay, so just to wrap up the paternity discussion, we mentioned how undergoing artificial insemination certainly would allow one to fulfill the mitzvah of Puravu according to Diane Weiss. We discussed posthumously born heirs as a machlokas between Shaul Yisraeli and Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. But certainly with regard to being considered the child of someone with regard to not marrying a sibling, that's obviously an issue according to Halacha. Question before we go on? Yeah?
Based on what you said about the law, it may have changed only with the Rachel Cohen case,
I don't know if the law was in reaction to this case, because the law was passed 2003. This case started in 2002. The law also states that the decision is made on a case-by-case basis by the courts in each individual situation. So maybe she was just going through that process to determine if there was any objection on the part of her son to this process. Okay, let's move on now to the brief discussion of the maternity issues. And here you can read an article from this past summer. Once again, London Times and Fox News. Maybe they specialize in this kind of thing, I don't know. This was a case that was presented at the most recent annual meeting of the European Society of Human Reproduction and Embryology in Lyon, France, this past summer. And apparently it's a first up in Canada, in Montreal. A 7-year-old girl could one day give birth to her biological half-brother or half-sister. What happened? A young girl, 7 years old, has Turner syndrome, a condition in which one of her X chromosomes is missing. She will be unable to conceive naturally. Her own mother, who is now 35 years old, took 21 of her own eggs and froze them. Cryopreservation. I believe it's called oocyte cryopreservation. She froze her own eggs so that in 15, 20 years from now, when her daughter will one day want to become a mother of her own, she will be unable to naturally with her own system. However, she will then be able to use her mother's eggs, have them fertilized by her own husband, implanted in her own body, carry them to term, and then give birth to, that's the question, to what? To her son, to her daughter, to her sister, to her brother. Obviously, you know, as far as the halacha is concerned, a very, very serious question. And the question becomes then, even in situations not as dramatic as this, but in any case of surrogate motherhood, where one woman is unable to conceive on her own and needs another woman to either carry the baby for her or to provide eggs for her to carry to term, whatever the case might be, how does halacha determine who the mother is? Does halacha view maternity as determined by the birth, by the genes, by the donor of the biological egg, by the pregnancy, by the gestation, perhaps by a combination of two of these factors? How does halacha deal with this issue? And here certainly there is, you know, very little in terms of precedent to look at. As rare as artificial insemination, you have maybe a couple of centuries to go back to, but this obviously is just, you know, recent years. So Tzitz Eliezer, just to quote one source number 7, is actually of the opinion that he was opposed altogether to IVF procedures, even before you get to surrogate motherhood, because he felt that even IVF procedures, he writes in source number 7, Mikevon shedarka hativis shel habetzis lios mechuberes leguf ha'isha v'lifros sham. Since naturally a woman's egg is part of her body, im kein berega shetolshim osa migufa umatkim osa mimokam gidula. The moment you detach and surgically remove this egg from the woman's body, misbatel hakesher hayachas beino levein ha'isha, you have severed that halachic relationship between the egg and the woman. And the Tzitz Eliezer therefore seems to be assuming that this is not something halacha would view favorably. He was, I believe, opposed to IVF altogether for this reason. Ironically, he himself, in a later tshuva, in response to a question posed to him, well, let's say it happens already, you know, what happens? He did take a stand on surrogate motherhood in terms of who the mother is, who the mother is not. But in terms of IVF, he initially seemed to oppose it because he felt this was not something that you could view as being the child of anybody, because it's not a child of the mother, because it's not connected to the mother anymore at the time of fertilization. But again, in leadership, we'll come back to later, he does take a side, if it already happened, as to who the mother would be. Perhaps one of the early sources to discuss this issue, this goes back to the 1920s, source number 8, let's correct the title here of the book. It should be Sefer HaTalmud UMadoe HaTevel. HaTevel with a tuf, not a tes, and Madoe as in Mada, not as in the Adni HaMishkan. The book written by Basil Kamelhar in 1920s was when this question was first discussed, perhaps theoretically at that time. And he discusses the following issue. He says, what happens? He says, v'hi b'derech agav, avi b'zeh shelech hadasha. A new question, he says. The regal hamtzah hadasha, a new discovery, asher himtziu ka'es lithkot akars ka'open zedev, found a new method of fertility. Choschim es shalal shal beitzim, me'isha balas banim. They remove surgically the ovaries from one woman. U'mecharim oso b'chadei betin hakar, and they surgically attach it to another woman. And that allows that other woman to become a mother. Now, this is back in 1928. I doubt that at that time they were actually practicing such surgeries. The first, I think, successful ovarian transplant was in China in 2004. The first successful ovarian transplant in this country was in St. Louis in 2005. So back in 1928, it was probably more science fiction than it was actual real practice. Yeah?
There were early attempts.
Oh, okay. There were early attempts, not successful attempts. Okay. So I don't know how far back they go in terms of practicing, attempting to do it. Do you know how far back it went? Around then? Okay. First successful attempt was 2004. So back in 1920s, they were perhaps thinking about it, trying it, but it didn't succeed at that time. So how does it deal with this question? Who's the mother? The donor of the eggs or the mother who actually then carries the baby to term and gives birth to the baby? So it finds a fascinating precedent in halacha from the halachas of Orla. Can't eat the fruit of a new tree for the first 3 years that it's around. How does that have anything to do with surrogate motherhood? So he says, well, the Gemara in Sotah Daf Mem Gimel tells us, Yalda says Savcha Bizkeinu. If you take a branch from a new tree and you graft it onto an older tree and it produces fruit, but le Yalda Bizkeinu ve'ein badin orla. The branch from the new tree, once it's grafted to the old tree, takes on the halachas of the old tree, and the fruit that this branch produces are not subject to the laws of orla. So he suggests, Kamelhar suggests, that perhaps with an ovarian transplantation as well, well, once you transplant the ovaries, so certainly it becomes part of the second woman's body, it's her child, nothing to worry about. Now, even if we accept that, but today's procedures very often do not involve ovarian transplantation from one body to another. They involve taking an egg from one woman, fertilizing it with someone's sample in a lab, and then waiting 3 days for an 8-cell embryo to form, then taking an 8-cell embryo 3 days after fertilization, and then implanting it in the host mother. So then the question still remains. Well, here I haven't made any transplant before the actual fertilization occurred. Here the fertilization occurs today before anything is put into the woman's body. The woman is now receiving a viable 8-cell embryo, which is now going to develop for the next 9 months in her body. But it was fertilized before it became a part of her body. So is she still considered the mother or not? So in source number 8, the Gemara in Yevamos is quoted as a very fascinating source. The Gemara here speaks of a non-Jewish mother who conceives twins and converts during pregnancy. And the Gemara tells us that as far as their father is concerned, since they were fathered or conceived when the father was a non-Jew, so halachically after their mother converts during pregnancy, they are now considered Jewish, the children, and they have no longer any relationship to their father who had fathered them when he was non-Jewish. Okay, so the Gemara says in Yevamos that two twin brothers who were converted, you know, in utero when their mother converted, they do not have to perform chalitza or yibum. Because as far as being related as brothers through their father, they're not considered brothers. They don't have the same father anymore. Because their father was a non-Jew when they were conceived, they are not considered brothers. However, says the Gemara, as far as being related as brothers through their mother with regard to the issur of marrying a sister-in-law, as far as being related as brothers through the same mother, they are considered brothers of the same mother. In this case, where the mother converted while she was pregnant with them. What does that seem to indicate? If we know that converts do not have a halachic relationship with their parents who conceived them or fathered them or became their parents before they converted, so what does this Gemara seem to indicate? Gemara seems to indicate that the relationship with the father, which began before the conversion when they were conceived, has been severed. They're no longer brothers through the father. But the relationship with the mother, the Gemara says, exists. They are considered brothers through the mother. In what case? Where the mother converts when she was pregnant with them. What does that seem to indicate? That means that even after the mother converted, they are still considered brothers through the mother. Why? Apparently because she became their mother after they converted. How? Well, either through the continued gestation or because of the birth that happened after the conversion. What this Gemara seems to indicate is that conception does not determine maternity in halacha. Because if conception, if the, you know, the donation of an egg determines maternity in halacha, then these brothers would have presumably no longer have a relationship with their mother if she converted after they were conceived. And yet the Gemara says that their relationship with their mother remains intact halachically because she converted before they were born, implying that the relationship of a mother to a child is brought about after after the conception, at the time of birth perhaps, or maybe right before birth, but at least certainly after conception. So this Gemara is cited by many as a proof that perhaps the halacha views maternity as being created at the moment, well, at least not at conception, not dependent on the genetic donor mother. There are, I believe, a minority opinion that views the donor mother as the mother in halacha, but I think the majority of poskim today reject that, and this is one of the Gemaras they cite. Another fascinating precedent that is cited is famous Chazal by Dina. Dina, we are told, was the daughter of Leah, that we know. Teitei Dina bas Leah. Dina was the daughter of Leah. The Chazal tell us that it wasn't so simple. In what way? So if you look at Rashi, Al Torah, source number 10, Rashi says that when Leah was born, when Leah was pregnant with Dina, Perashu Rabbah Seinu Shadana Leah Din Ba'atzma. Leah thought to herself, Imzeh Zachar, if I have a son now, Lo Tehi Racha Lachosi Ka'achas HaShvachos, I'm going to have my seventh son, and the maidservants have two each. Yaakov's going to have only 12 tribes, so how many is Rachel going to have? Only one. That's not going to be too nice for my sister. She'll have only one son. The maidservants will have more than she has. So Rashi says, what happened? Hispalu alav v'nepach l'nekeva. Dina Leah davened, and the embryo she was carrying changed from a boy to a girl. Okay, pretty innocuous. Tzvila helps. Baby was changed from a boy to a girl. That doesn't really apply to us here. But what does maybe apply is Targum Yonasan ben Azil, who has a different take on what happened here. Targum Yonasan ben Azil says that in the second line of source number 11, in the middle of the line, he says, Shemiah min Padam Hashem slusid Leah, God heard Leah's prayers, v'ishalfu ubarai v'me'ehom, there was an in-utero embryo switch, v'havayah v'yosef b'mad Rachel, v'dina b'mad Leah, God took Yosef from Leah's womb and transplanted him to Rachel's womb, and took Dina from Rachel's womb and transplanted her to Leah's womb. Now, what actually happened literally, I don't know. But if you read the Targum Yonasan ben Azil, what is he saying? He's saying that there was a miraculous in utero embryo transfer that Leah originally had in her Yosef. Rachel originally had in her Dina. And God miraculously switched them. That Dina went from Rachel to Leah, and Yosef went from Leah to Rachel. And as we know, who is Dina always the daughter of? Dina is the daughter of Leah. So what would that seem to indicate? That you look not at who conceived as the mother, but at who gave birth as the mother. So this is actually very fascinatingly quoted as a potential source for this question. Maybe that shows us how desperate we are because we have no real or rare shortage of halachic precedent for this kind of question. Now, obviously, this is a divrei agata. You know, to pass such a serious shaila on the basis of this alone would be very, very shaky. But it's interesting nonetheless. And I guess it's quoted as just an added support, so to speak, to buttress the previous Gemara in Maseches Yevamos. As I was driving to Yeshiva this morning, I called my uncle, Moshe Soloveitchik, who once wrote an article in an Orem Mizrach magazine, Orem Mizrach journal, with regard to this issue. So he told me that shortly before Rav Moshe Feinstein died, Rav Moshe had paskined on such shilas that the birth mother is the halachic mother in these kinds of questions, these kinds of cases. And my uncle said that he posed the question to Rav Moshe, that he said the Perish Hatur Ha'aruch Al HaTorah asks, how was Shimon allowed to marry his sister Dina according to Chazal? So the Torah says, not so terrible, because Dina was actually originally conceived by Rachel. What does that seem to say? That what? Right. So my uncle said that Rav Moshe was amazed by the question. He enjoyed it very much, because it would seem to indicate, according to the Torah anyways, that the fact that Rachel was the, according to Chazal, the ones who conceived Dina is being used by the Torah as an explanation as to why Shimon was allowed to marry her, implying that Rachel has some claims of maternity here. So Rav Moshe responded, my uncle told me that according to the Torah, perhaps we take into account not just the birth, but we take into account who was the gestational mother for the longest period of time. That's how Rav Moshe phrased it. Meaning the Torah perhaps is assuming, said Rav Moshe, that Rachel had Yosef for the longest, had Dina for the longest period of time in her womb, and therefore she was then considered the mother. But Rav Moshe said, you could still argue, even according to the Torah, that if you have a donor egg which is implanted right after fertilization into one mother who then carries it for 9 months, the 9 months gestation would still be the halachic mother according to the Torah as well. That was Rav Moshe's response. Now this is only a question according to the Torah, who makes this comment that seems to attribute some halachic significance to the mother at the moment of conception. But even so, Rav Moshe said, according to the Torah, you could still argue that if gestation, you know, is more in one mother than in another, perhaps gestation is the critical determinant, not the conception alone. But Rav Moshe is certainly paskin that in cases of surrogate motherhood, it's the birth mother that is the halachic mother. And even according to the Torah, he held that that would be true because in most cases today, the birth mother is the one who carries the child for the longest period of time. Actually, in all cases today. The birth mother carries the baby for the longest period of time. My uncle told me, however, that Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, my grandfather, instead of looking at the birth alone as the determinant, had a bit of a slightly different psak on this issue. Not that it made halacha l'maisa a difference, but he had different hagadara, different guidelines for determining the motherhood. And he said the following. The bottom source, number 14, Gemara Yevamos, the Gemara speaks of a Bas Kohen, the daughter of a Kohen, who married a Yisrael. Okay, so the halacha is, she's married to Yisrael, she can't eat truma. What happens if her husband, the Yisrael, dies, and she has no children? She's allowed to go back to her father's home and eat the truma that her father was feeding her until she got married. So the Gemara says, what happens if she doesn't know if she's carrying a child from her Yisrael husband? What does she do then? So the Gemara says that she can continue to eat for the first 40 days of this potential conception. Why? Because if it turns out she's not pregnant, so she's allowed to eat shuma anyway. She's not pregnant. She's the daughter of a Kohen. Her husband died. She can eat shuma. If, however, she is pregnant, for the first 40 days, says the Gemara, Maya Ba'amahi. The fetus is really inconsequential. It's only Maya Ba'ama. So my uncle, based on this Gemara, suggested to my grandfather concurred, that apparently from this Gemara you see that a fetus in the first 40 days is really irrelevant as far as halacha is concerned. And perhaps then with regard to motherhood, maternity as well, you could not possibly claim that, well, maternity is established before the 40-day point because it's Maya Ba'ama. You're the mother of what? There's nothing to speak of here. So my grandfather agreed that the maternity claim would be established based on who was the gestational mother, the one who carried the fetus, at the 40-day point. Once again, halacha l'maaseh is not much of a distinction, because today when we perform these IVF procedures, even when there is a donor egg from another woman, which is then fertilized in the lab and implanted into the infertile woman who was carrying this egg to term, the implantation is done about 3 days after the fertilization. So certainly at day 40, it's already going to be implanted into the birth mother, so there's not going to be much of a difference, halacha l'maaseh, as far as who the mother is concerned, whether you follow Rav Moshe's psak of the birth being the determinant of the mother, or my grandfather's suggestion that you follow the determinant as being the 40-day mark as who the mother is. Just to wrap up, halacha l'maaseh with regards to this issue, Rav Herschel Schachter Shlita is of the opinion that despite the sources we quoted here just now, because there is real, no hardcore precedence for this kind of question, Rav Schachter and Shlomo Zalman Auerbach as well are both of the opinion that you still have to be concerned. Even though there is a preponderance of evidence that the birth mother is the actual mother, you still have to be concerned that perhaps the biological mother is the mother as well. And Rav Schachter, for that reason, paskins that in the case of a donor egg, if, let's say, as is often the case in this country, it would be provided by a non-Jewish woman to a Jewish woman, so even though the Jewish mother carries the baby to term for 9 months and gives birth to the mother, and is very possibly the mother according to the sources we indicated here, but you still have to be concerned, says Rav Schachter, that the donor mother, the biological mother, is a mother according to halacha. And Rav Schachter therefore would advise that in such situations, the baby should undergo a gerus just to be sure, just to cover the possibility that in case the donor mother is the mother, and if that donor mother is not Jewish, you have to undergo a gerus, the baby has to undergo a gerus. You know, in a situation where the donor mother would be a Jew, a Jewish woman, so there the issue wouldn't be an issue of gerus. There the issue would be, well, if she has perhaps two mothers, she can't marry the siblings from either mother. So then you'd have to know exactly who the donor woman is so that you can ensure that there's not going to be any problem of siblings marrying one another someday down the line. I believe that Machon Pua, what they do in Eretz Yisrael, where of course most donor women are Jewish, is they take the birth date of the donor mother, and that way when the child is one day going to be getting married, I guess the first question that the baby's child's going to ask on the date is, you know, not what color tablecloth you put on the table for Shabbos, but what date was your mother born on? So that's obviously a very serious issue. That's how to deal with it in Eretz Yisrael. I just saw that there's a proposed law change on the books in Britain that they want to now officially stamp the papers of all IVF children with, you know, the identities of their biological and adoptive or gestational parents, that there's never any question as to who is who. I'm sorry? The donor mother has to be single if she's Jewish. According to Rav Moshe, there's never any question of mamzerus, so there's certainly no problem at all. According to others, if you view mamzerus as being a problem, even when there's just a mixture of zera, so to speak, then others might require that she be single. In Eretz Yisrael, for example, for many years, the law in the books in the Knesset was that a surrogate mother must be single. Recently, Rav Amar allowed even a married woman to serve as a surrogate mother because there was some financial distress involved. They were unable to afford the cost of a surrogate mother. Right, I understand, right. So I'm saying donor mother as well. According to Moshe, there's no problem if the mother is married, even if the mother is related to the recipient. But if you view mamzeres as being dependent on, you know, a mixture of zera alone, then there would be an issue. I can't say for sure. I don't know offhand. I just know that in general in Eretz Yisrael, they always used, for surrogate mothers, they used single women until Rav Amar made this exception, which caused a bit of an uproar. But just to wrap up, I think if we just quickly recap, we saw that with regard to the surrogate mother versus the birth mother versus the biological mother, Most poskim seem inclined to assume that the birth mother is the actual mother of the child. However, because it's such a very unclear case with very little precedent, if any precedent at all, Shlomo Zalman and Rav Schechter both assume that one should be concerned that both mothers might have mother status in halacha. And for that reason, if the donor mother is a non-Jew, they would require a geiris just to be sure of the child. And if the donor mother is a Jew, they would require very careful records to be kept as to, you know, to avoid any possibility of siblings marrying one another.